Hello everyone, welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today I am joined by Kostas Zarifis, Creative Director for Tin Hearts. Tin Hearts is a Lemmings-inspired game. In each level, you direct your toy soldiers to the destination, but you don't control them. You need to manipulate the environment around them so that they can find a path on their own. And Kostas, on top of the creative director role, so the role which takes responsibility for all the features that go into the game and pretty much the vision and the game as a creative project, he also is a managing director for Rogue Sun, so the studio that made Tin Hearts. So he needed to balance both of these roles, and it's not an easy feat. The game had quite long and quite stormy history, but in the end landed in a beautiful manner and accompanied by an incredible soundtrack by Matthew Chastney is a staggering game. And with that, that's Kostas Zarifis on Tin Hearts. Hello Kostas, and tell me a bit about yourself and Tin Hearts.
Hi Lucas, thanks so much for having me. My name is Kostas Zarifis, and I am the creative director of Tin Hearts, and I'm also managing director of Rogue Sun. Rogue Sun was founded back in 2016, so we've been around for quite some time now. We've done a whole bunch of stuff, although yeah, Tin Hearts is kind of our most sort of public-facing project. It was officially released back in May of last year, and since then it's kind of been, you know, the first year of support, I guess. It's been released on pretty much every platform. Most recently was released on Game Pass, which was very cool. It was kind of a Christmas launch, and we had a fun Christmas kind of DLC, sort of Die Hard themed DLC, and hopefully in the next few days we'll also be releasing the VR version of the game. So it's been kind of a, you know, long release window given all the platforms we had to support. But yeah, after the VR version, I think, you know, we're just gonna sort of stay there, and just kind of, you know, do a bit more support, I guess, quality of life support. Cause yeah, all the platforms we wanted to target will have been targeted. So that will be a good point to take a break, I guess, from, the platform releases.
Yeah. And you targeted pretty much every platform you could with the game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an interesting journey because, you know, back in 2016, when the studio was founded, Tin Hearts kind of was our first game. And some of our more kind of long-standing community members will remember that, Tin Hearts came out in, say, 2019, as a VR-only, game. It was back then, it was what we now call Act One, I guess, of the title. So it was the first 3 hours, let's say. You know, Tin Hearts is deceptively big game. So it's about, you know, 10 to 15 hours, depending how good you are at puzzle games, I guess. So back then it was kind of like, you know, one third to one fifth, I guess, of the full content of the full story we kind of wanted to tell. And it was self-published, you know, we're quite keen, obviously, to finish that story. Whether we should have done it as a sequel as opposed to, you know, what we ended up doing is, you know, maybe something we'll discuss later, kind of in the learnings, I guess, and sort of, you know, introspection and self-reflection, I guess. We did want to finish that story, and given it was self-published back then, there was an opportunity to kind of keep pitching the game to publishers. And I want to say around 2020, we were lucky enough to secure a collaboration with Wired Productions, our current publisher with Tin Hearts, who were keen to support us in this vision of, you know, finishing the story of Tin Hearts and completing the full game.
and also bringing it to all platforms, because you know, back in 2016 when we first conceived of it, we got a bit of funding from Oculus back then, and that's why, you know, it was kind of focused in the VR space. But it is a puzzle slash narrative game, first and foremost. And while it is very cool to play in VR, you know, our view was that we wanted to, you know, bring the story and the gameplay and the puzzles to as many players as possible. And that meant, you know, targeting all the platforms. And of course, doing the work to make sure that it's a fun experience and, you know, feels, you know, like a very, like a native experience on, regardless of which platform you're playing it on. Whether we succeeded, in that, I guess we'll see. But
it started, yeah. It started as a VR, then you at some point switched to like focus on a PC console build, and then now you're finishing the version, like a full VR version.
Exactly, 100%. So when we were working on just the VR version, you know, back in, you know, 2016, 2017, 2018, we actually had the full game white boxed. And, you know, for any of your listeners who don't know what that means, it's basically, you know, you do the entire level design, I guess, and kind of the key beats of each level in terms of any cutscenes, any, you know, any important kind of gameplay events, just with very basic, you know, primitive shapes, you know, cubes, capsules, that sort of thing. And usually, you know, that they are white shapes, hence white boxing or gray boxing, some people call it. So you could effectively play, you know, this 12 hour kind of experience that I mentioned. You could play it since, you know, way back then in VR, from start to finish. A lot of the, you know, the puzzles weren't fully fleshed out. You know, some of the levels were, you know, more white box, more prototype and white box than others. You know, other levels were more kind of final or closer to what we ended up having. But, you know, it was lacking some key features that we added later when we, you know, when the project was signed by Y Productions. And the focus was shifted, you know, to the non-VR platforms. And then, you know, to actually go back and, add those features to the VR version or content, you know, some of them were features and mechanics, like the direct control soldier or the pathing system. And again, we can come back to these later, but they were kind of, you know, big features. And to go back, or like I said, you know, I mentioned content as well. So, you know, so we had some massive levels, that needed a lot of interesting optimization, you know, going back to, you know, something that's now targeting the PlayStation 5, for example, to go back to, VR platforms and, you know, even especially untethered VR platforms, very different kind of, specifications, hardware specifications. So, you know, to do that journey from like native VR, you know, room scale, almost, you know, like a lot of the focus back at the very start was kind of like room scale and very native VR, to then making sure that it plays really nicely and smoothly on consoles and PC, mouse and keyboard, and then back to VR. You know, it was a very interesting journey, kind of production and engineering wise.
What was the team, and how the team changed over the because like 7 years, right? Eight years?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And you know, I the answer is probably very interesting, in that, from, you know, again, from a production kind of point of view, in that actually we internally look at it as Tin Hearts 2.0 and, you know, Tin Hearts 1.0, because we basically, while we were looking at trying to get the full game funded, we were working on other things. So the game went on ice, you know, full kind of cryostasis kind of mode, for a good, you know, three years at least, right? Because I said 2019 and then And even then, you know, like immediately after the first VR launch, we kind of had to, we did a bit of support to, because we had the non-VR version kind of up and running relatively quickly. So we had a lot of the Act 1 levels. You could play them with just, you know, controller or mouse and keyboard. While we were finishing off that Act 1, that prologue, that early access, because we launched it, we self-published in early access, like I said. So we had those levels kind of working mostly so we could be pitching, you know, the non-VR version to publishers. And there was a lot of, you know, kind of cards on the table. There was a lot of, because I mentioned we wanted to get the game out to as many places as possible, but so did the publishers that we were talking to, right? Obviously, VR is, still is, obviously it's been growing and growing and growing, but compared to, you know, your console market, your PC market, is still tiny. So, you know, there weren't that many publishers that were interested in a VR-only game. So we wanted to make sure that we had that pitch demo there where, you know, people could sit down and play it with mouse and keyboard, put on the VR headset if they wanted to, and kind of sample it in both ways. And it was quite unique as well in that, you know, you could sample it in whichever way you kind of wanted. And it's been nice to see this in our community as well, where we have players who finished it in, you know, on their, you know, with mouse and keyboard on their PC, and now they're, or their PlayStation 5, and now they're eagerly, you know, wanting to have another go in VR. So, you know, that was kind of our USP, I guess, pitching publishers. But then it went on ice, and obviously the company, the studio had to keep going. So we were working on other projects, none of which I can really go into too much detail about, because they're all kind of under NDA, especially. So we did, you know, I guess a bunch of work for hire, you know, work with other studios supporting their projects, and some internal stuff as well, which is kind of still hush hush. So, and then obviously the studio, the team, kind of the composition of the team kind of was changing, because we're talking, like I say, we're talking about a period of like a couple of years, 2-3 years between Tin Hearts 1.0 and Tin Hearts and the beginning of Tin Hearts 2.0. And what that meant as well was, luckily, restarting the project, we did have some of the key, kind of members of the original team were still there. Most of the key team members were still there, but we kind of had to pass that torch, you know, as the new team was forming from, you know, members of the other teams that I mentioned, the work for hire teams, the other internal projects that we were doing. You know, we started the Tin Hearts 2.0 team, started absorbing those members, but there was a period of, like, you know, passing that torch on, to kind of the new team. Toby, for example, who I know you've spoken to recently, you know, a member of the Tin Hearts 2.0 team, and, you know, he's done an absolutely amazing job of, you know, like, owning that responsibility. But it was kind of an interesting thing for me, kind of being in the end, you know, over the years, I think I am now the only member from Tin Hearts 1.0, because, as you said, you know, it's a 7-year project. Yeah. If you look at it from start to finish, I think it's more like a 3-4 year project when you look at the actual time spent kind of developing it. But, you know, it's a long time for, and people move around. But it was kind of, especially at the start for me, you know, kind of being the keeper of all of that knowledge, and having the members of the kind of Tin Hearts 2.0 team come to me going, how does this work again? What is this meant to do? Where is this meant to be? And, you know, it was a lot of pressure and kind of making sure, you know, that original vision, which hasn't really changed, you know, when it comes to the story for sure. I mean, you know, outside of the story, we did add a lot of stuff. Yeah, it was a lot of pressure. And it was also for me very interesting to see how my role gradually, you know, kind of, you know, the keeper of the, you know, Moses coming down from the mountain. It was kind of like that started being sort of, it started kind of evaporating as people started absorbing a lot of that. And it was, for me, you know, it was very nice to see, you know, at one point I was having to kind of feed into all the conversations and kind of go, no, that's not quite right. This is how that's meant to work. Where, you know, I'd start typing something and, you know, on our teams, and then, I'd see someone else going, no, that's how this works. I'd be like, oh, cool. Yeah, that's a character. I don't have to do this anymore. Yes. You know, I'm not. Yeah. So it's been a very interesting kind of journey, for, you know, as you said, like how the team transitioned and how the composition kind of changed over all these years.
So Tino Hearts 2.0, how did the team look like then for the 2.0 part? Like, how many artists, designers, programmers were working?
Yeah. So it started, so 2.0 kind of started, and again, you know, I said I can't really talk too much about some of the other projects that we're doing in the meantime, but I guess what I can say is, it was an interesting time for the studio because we were working on a big, big, big project, that got canned by that publisher, as it often happens in the games industry. And my role, you know, my role had kind of transitioned in that project. You know, I was kind of transitioning away from that project internally, kind of looking at other work for hire stuff. And, but I could sort of see that that project wasn't headed towards a good place. And at that point, because that other project was so big and it was providing a lot of stability for the studio, you know, because as a startup, as a young, small studio, you know, traditionally we've only ever been, you know, 10. So there's 15 of us right now, and we've only ever been kind of, you know, in that sort of zone of 10, 15, you know, but when we're working on that project, we were 20, 25 or so. I think that was kind of our peak. But I could see that the project was heading for cancellation. It was just kind of not heading there. And I kind of started, that was around the time when I was kind of like, okay, we need something else to be able to make sure that, to ensure our kind of stability. And that was kind of when we really doubled down on the pitching of Tin Hearts. I think actually Wired had already reached out to us. Because, yeah, the way that pitch happened was we pitched them, and at the time they said, we love this, but we can't take it on right now. But then they came back like, you know, 6 months, 9 months later going, we'd love to do it, actually, which, doesn't happen often, but I guess it happens sometimes. But because we're working on this other project, I said, well, we can do it now. I don't think we have capacity. But then because of the direction of this other project, I went back to them and I said, okay, we might be able to do it.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. This. But because I wasn't entirely sure how things were going to play out with the other project, we started kind of seeding the team. I told them we will resume production on this project. Cause like I told you earlier, it was completely on ice, right? We had to pull the code again and update the version of Unity, which was ancient, you know, start doing all of that work. So at that point, it was effectively myself, Toby, and another artist. So three people basically just kind of, you know, trying to revive it, you know, giving it CPR, and updating, you know, versions of Unity, figuring out that all kinds of things are not working anymore, because it's ancient, you know, SDKs have changed, and all kinds of things. And then also kind of trying to, I guess, set up the production roadmap, knowing that, okay, this time we're doing the full thing, right? We're not doing just act one, but we're doing a white boxing. We're doing act two, act three, act four. And, you know, it's going to need to have like the full content, all the levels, all the cutscenes, everything. So just kind of doing that planning, I guess. And it all kind of, you know, slotted in nicely. And when I say nicely, I mean the other project got cancelled at about the right time where, you know, the pre-production. I know it's funny. It's, you know, my ancestors, the ancient Greeks, would say it's comical and tragic at the same time, right? Because, you know, if we didn't have Thin Hearts kind of, if we hadn't revived it, a lot of, so some people obviously moved on kind of naturally, but we were able, Thin Hearts were able to absorb a lot of the team members of this other project. And, you know, we were able to, hold on to those jobs. Because, like pre-production had finished, pre-production 2.0 had finished, and we were like, right, okay, now we need another couple of artists here, two engineers here, you know, few level designers, and, you know, kind of hired again a little bit. But yeah, so it was kind of a gradual. So, like I said, it started with like three people, and then at its peak, it was, like I said, like 15 people or so. So, and it was a kind of an even split between, you know, about three artists, three coders, three level designers. I think just one animator actually. But yeah, it was gradually over the course of like a couple of years of the 2.0 phase, we went from 3 to 15.
Okay. And how much of the systems that were already in place in 1.0 you could really use, and how much of them you needed to like rewrite?
Yeah, so again, not that much. Again, a really good question, an interesting question. And again, this is kind of one of the downsides of taking too long to complete a game, is that the sort of ecosystem of things you might be using, you know, assets, plugins, SDKs, obviously changes, and everyone loves to claim their things are backwards compatible or whatever, but that's rarely the case, right? And, you know, there were some things anyway that needed a good refresh, you know, for 2.0, because the main one being kind of the physics system. Well, I mean, I say physics system really. So in your conversation with Toby, you probably heard that, and I mentioned already, we're using the Unity engine. Now the Unity engine is not a deterministic engine, which means, you know, you might run a simulation five times with the same kind of input values, and you might get five different results. Right. And in our case, what that meant was in version 1.0, when we were purely relying on Unity's, physics engine, and in our game, and I guess we haven't really talked about what the game is about, but super briefly, it's a Lemmings-like where you lead, you know, a troop of little toy soldiers from the beginning to the exit. And while you do that, you kind of find out more about the life of their creator, who was a genius Victorian toy maker. That's the kind of elevator pitch. That's it, Thin Hearts in a nutshell. But yeah, in any Lemmings-like game, obviously, you know, you want your 10 lemmings, your 10 toy soldiers to follow the same path, right? If given no changes in, you know, their environment, you'd expect them to, you know, go up the book and then jump down the drum, which in our game, drums are trampolines, and then grab a balloon to float over there. That would not happen as often as we'd like in version 1.0, because we're relying on Unity's physics engine, which, as I said, was not deterministic. So, you know, you might have 9 toy soldiers doing the thing you'd expect them, and then one of them is over there, and you're like, you know, players were like, what's he doing over there? And that was a very frustrating kind of core issue, I guess, right, to the experience that we really wanted to address. Since that version, and we were doing kind of, and especially, yeah, so this is the other thing, because we had this fast forward mechanic, which is essential. I mean, even going back to the first Lemmings game, you know, once you solve the puzzle, you just want to fast forward the simulation and go, right, you know, just get everyone in the exit, move on, you know, to the next level. But what that does, obviously, when you have a real kind of physics simulation in the background, is your physics becomes even more inaccurate, because, you know, your kind of sample becomes wider, and, you know, you might miss collisions and all kinds of things. So we knew that we could not rely on that for the final full product. So that's one system that took a while to, during phase 2.0, to change, refactor entirely. So we had to roll out our own solution, which again I'm sure Toby went into a lot of depth, so I'm not going to repeat. The other thing was, you know, the kind of stuff I mentioned already. For example, we were using the native, because it was out on Steam VR and it was out on Oculus. But this time around, obviously, we wanted to target PSVR as well. And already was kind of, it wasn't ideal. It wasn't super efficient, kind of handling the different kind of native integrations. And, you know, especially if it meant we'd had to roll out a third one. In the meantime, Unity had rolled out their own kind of XR SDK. So, you know, we're like, okay, well, it makes sense to transition everything to this. And then it just means that we can handle all the platforms within, you know, the one kind of wrapper. Obviously, you know, everyone likes to claim that they're doing things cleanly, but, you know, there was the odd kind of direct call inside of, like, gameplay code to, like, some sort of low-level, you know, Steam VR kind of function. And then, you know, we'd find bugs. So it took a while. It wasn't too bad, you know, maybe like a couple of months or something, one, two months to transition to Unity's XR kit.
Two months for just the transition. It's a lot, right? If you look at the project, obviously in the span of the project, it might not be that much. But if you can have 1 month and you can use 1 month to do the thing that is kind of needed, but will not be seen as such, it makes a
difference. That's the worst thing about it, right? Because the end player has no, they don't directly gain any value from that 1-2 months of work. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at it that way, it is frustrating, but yeah, it's the kind of stuff you have to do.
Yeah. And Tina Hart, first of all, you've made an amazing elevator pitch for the game, like one line, succinctly telling what is it about. Tina Hart has a lot of subsystems and they all interplay with each other. And since you're saying that you started with like 1.0, if I can like enumerate some of them, it's like, first of all, music and sound, which I am listening on a quite frequent occasion to OST from Tina Hart. It's amazing. Nice. It's very, it's very somewhat melancholic, but very beautiful and relaxing. But then you have programming systems, like subsystems that actually need to power the game. You have a lot of work in different levels, depending on whether you're walking around the house or you're inside the level or you're in this like tutorial when things float around and they're shaded and there's a lot of shadows. So it's a lot of variety of these things. And all like the usual systems like animation that you kind of tweaked, at least for the toy soldiers and things that need to follow the path that we discussed with Toby. How these systems, from the production perspective, like when do you think about them? When do you start to include, for example, music? And do you think of it like with the music where it's supposed to drive the experience? Is it added later on? Like, how do you handle actual doing things in order? What's the order of importance for them?
Yeah, so again, I think it's a great question, but in our particular case, I think the answer is, again, interesting in that I think, you know, if you're working on like Valve time, right? Everyone knows about Valve time. It's ready when it's ready, or Blizzard time. Yeah. It's ready when it's ready. It's ready when it feels good. It plays perfect and all that. I think, you know, we, for better or worse, we do approach things, or we end up with, you know, Tina Hart's as a creative director. I think I'm super spoiled because, you know, where we ended up with the end game, you know, it's a pretty uncompromising, sort of, end product. You know, we really managed to deliver, a very ambitious, against a very ambitious vision, which you just described there. And a big part of that ambition was exactly the thing you said around like the different subsystems. You know, lots of different, you know, there's basically like tons of different games really, in this one experience. Yeah. I mean, it's a Lemmings like, you guide the soldiers from point A to point B, but the way that, evolves, over the course of those, you know, 10, 12 hours, is always fresh, always interesting. And that was kind of a big part of the vision from kind of day one, you know. And I think for me personally, the games I tend to enjoy are the games that kind of keep me on my toes in terms of, you know, just when I feel like I figured it out, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah, I see what they're trying to do here. It's like, have another thing. And it's like, oh, hang on. Oh, this is, I did not expect this. Like, you know, this changes things. This changes, and especially the way it plays into place with other things already. So yeah, so that was kind of something that we wanted to have. Like, we were telling ourselves, like, the player needs to be surprised and kind of delighted and challenged, all the way up to like the final hour of the game, right? Like we don't want them to feel like, obviously they're using tools, right? We're giving them tools constantly and they're using those tools, but the arsenal of tools needs to be like enriched, you know, all the way up to the final level. There's a new thing that we introduce. That sounds great, you know, in terms of like a product that we're putting together for an end consumer. It's a lot of work for the team making that product. Now the way to actually answer your question, the way we tried to optimize around that was going back to what we're saying about the physics engine and the pathing system and the locomotion of the soldiers. We were trying to parallelize the work as much as possible. And I guess to a degree, cross our fingers that things would slot in at the right time. And, you know, almost have like teams kind of working independently. So you had like the level design team or the puzzle design team kind of working independently to the engineering team. Obviously they are coordinating in terms of like what we want to have. But, you know, a lot of the puzzles, a lot of the mechanics were prototyped by, you know, the level design team, before we had the proper real systems, in place to facilitate that experience. You know, so we were just kind of mocking up the gameplay in very kind of hacky ways, and kind of, you know, hoping, praying that, you know, the real systems would slot in at the right times during our milestone plan, our roadmap, such that, you know, the experience would be cohesive and robust and, you know, bug free. That was, and I'll, you know, this was kind of the production approach. It was a lot of pressure on the team. I'll put my hand up because, you know, people would, you know, on occasion raise concerns about is this going to work? Like, you know, what if it doesn't work? And we're like, okay, you know, we're going to throw this out. You know, we're going to, you know, cross that bridge when we get to it. Right. You know, there weren't often, you know, great contingencies, I guess. It did work. Right. But you know, I'm not trying to claim that. You know, a lot of that was luck, I think. A lot of that was luck. And we did delay. I think, you know, that May launch was a good 6 months later than, what we were hoping. I mentioned, yeah, May 2023. Originally we were hoping to be out for Christmas 2022. So yeah, we did delay. So, you know, if any contingencies were there, you know, they were only there in the form of, you know, absorbing the cost in, you know, pushing the, our kind of roadmap, stretching our roadmap. Yeah. You know, I'm personally glad that we were able to do that because, you know, like I said, the end product is very close to the vision, you know, from a very selfish, like creative director kind of point of view. You know, I think that was great. It is a little bit risky that I'm also heavily involved in the production side because, you know, I think if that weren't the case, we do have Chris, our kind of, you know, proper producer. But yeah, I think it's harder, you know, when the creative director is also the managing director, I think it's harder for kind of people to go, nah, we're just going to cut that, right?
Yeah.
And we do have those conversations, and depending on what it is, you know, I'll often say, okay, yeah, sure, let's cut that. But yeah, there have been also times when I go, no, I'm going to draw a line. We can't lose this. It's important. You know, let's find something else to lose, or let's see how we can make it happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a case of like parallelizing the work. We did not have the luxury of going, we'll finish this, and then when it's done, we're going to try and use it over here to build the thing. It was like, no, we're building the thing. We're building on a house of cards while, you know, someone else is building the proper foundations, and then someone's going to hold this and someone's going to slot the foundation under this thing, and it's probably going to go wrong. And it often did, right? It would usually have, like, when we're merging this work, would have like a week or two of, like, you know, all kinds of conflicts. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, that approach worked.
Yeah. And you're mentioning like the tin heart is super polished. Like you can feel the attention to detail when you play it and you start it. And the one thing that you mentioned, that you like the games that have more surprises, like they don't let the players to think like that they already figure out all the gameplay. In Tin Hearts, it's astonishing. Like with each thing, there's something that changes, and it's like, for all the listeners, this will probably contain some spoilers. So if you want to like have this relief, this amazing moments, like dreamlike, ooh, that's those surprises, you should play the game. But for example, the embodying characters, for me, it was just like, ooh. Now, since I know a little bit about game making, I know how much work would that be to have games that levels with that they are playable from this like top-down perspective where you look from afar, and then you need to embody the soldier and be walk around in this different scale, different, and everything needs to work out. It's a lot of work. So this is really unexpected. The more unexpected it is, because I know how hard would it be for the making part. So this is these you managed to pull off really nicely. I think surprises moments.
Yeah, thank you. The embodying thing, yeah, it's a, I guess a bit of a spoiler, but I mean, yeah, there's many, many surprises in the game. So I think we can afford spoiling a few in this conversation. But, yeah, that was definitely something that I was really, you know, going back to what we were saying about, you know, where do we compromise and where do we kind of draw a line and go, no, we need to make this happen. That was one of the things where I was quite adamant that we need to have this mechanic, because, you know, with the length of the experience, with the length of the story that we're trying to tell, you know, I felt, cause it, you might have seen it kind of comes in sort of around the, you know, halfway point, you know, just before the halfway point, I think, of the experiences when we drop this, and it does add, as you said, you know, an entire new dimension to the gameplay. Cause, you know, the pure kind of lemmings, experience, I think I'm not sure it could have, carried, you know, the length of the game we wanted to have. But we, you know, we always envisioned that as a, you know, it's not meant to be like a full on third person, like action platformer, right? It was kind of meant to be almost like another mechanic, another tool in your arsenal. Like we give you the blocks and we give you the pinwheels and we give you, you know, in Act 3, like, you know, the mechanical devices and things. So it was meant to be one more such thing. Obviously, as you said, you know, it has more significance than that because yes, now you're down on the worktops and the shelves and, you know, the kind of level design needs to account for that. But yeah, it was kind of like, it's not meant to be like an exploration game. It was kind of like, you know, the player will need to figure out the specific kind of platforming path they need to take as part of the overall puzzle. And then really we just kind of flesh out that sort of area in terms of the kind of level design. So, you know, again, it was kind of done, I think, as efficiently as possible. Because again, we don't really have the means. I mean, thank you for the comment on Polish. I think, you know, if my team can speak freely, you know, I think I've banged the Polish drum, more than people would have appreciated. Because again, you know, we don't really have the capacity to do kind of AAA levels of Polish. But I think, you know, for our means, we've definitely done a great job. And I think, you know, like, it's an old school game in many ways. And I think, you know, the kind of the Polish aspect as well, maybe, you know, cause I'm ex Lionhead. I've worked on the Fable games, you know, Fable 2, Fable 3. And, you know, those were uncompromising kind of experiences as well in terms of the experience they were trying to deliver. And I think, you know, some of that legacy, sort of, you know, permeates and it's interesting because, you know, I don't think necessarily that's appreciated as much, you know, with today's kind of gaming audiences. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, because, you know, like we talk about crunch in the industry and, you know, it's better these days, but, you know, it still is a problem. And, you know, I think in the AAA space as well, like, you know, when you have games where, you know, you go into some house and some NPC's house and you open a drawer and then there's this amazing, like, I don't know, ring in there that's got like a million polys, and it's like, wow, like no one would have seen this, right, if I hadn't opened this particular drawer or whatever. But some artists probably worked like, you know, a week on this one ring. And it's kind of like, well, that's great if it like really adds to the fun of the experience, but if it doesn't, then, you know, was it worth the effort kind of thing, right? I think for us, you know, we look at it, and I was thinking about this today, actually, randomly. I went for a walk with my youngest and we walked past this house and my boy went, oh, look at that door. Doesn't it look like the door from, Act 3, the basement? I was like, yeah, I guess it does. Yeah, so for us, it's kind of like we definitely wanted to capture that atmosphere of the place. And I think, you know, like the individual, you know, like that ring that I mentioned, you know, the individual, like little details, you know, you might not appreciate them individually, but like I do think, you know, they add like this cohesive kind of package. So, you know, there was certainly a lot of that, like trying to make sure that the Butterworth's house was a memorable kind of place where you almost feel like you visited it in real life, right? Which again is something that I personally appreciate in games that I've played and have stayed with me. It's like, you know, the place, the feeling of place is so strong where you feel like I've actually been there, right?
Yeah. When did the music, the actual tracks, came about during the
So development? The music, yeah, we've had so many nice comments and so much great feedback on audio and music in the game. And I couldn't be happier about that because it's all you know, to Matthew Chastney, our amazing sound designer and composer. It's all to his credit. He's a special guy, an amazing artist and musician. And I've worked with him for well over a decade now. Yeah, I think, you know, when anyone on my team, you know, gets recognition, it makes me super proud. But, yeah, especially in Matthew's case, it's super well deserved. Also, especially because, you know, he's completely sort of, self-driven and kind of independent. Like a lot of his work is completely, you know, a lot of the kind of stuff we do internally on the project as a studio, you know, is very collaborative, very iterative, you know, brainstormy. You know, we'll look at we'll come up with concepts, you know, for, let's say, puzzle design, you know, we'll come up with concepts, then we'll play test, we'll implement a level, then we'll play test it, iterate, and so on and so forth. With Matthew's stuff, a lot of it is just Matthew. You know, he famously would say, we'll do a bunch of work and it's all silent, and you know, there's no audio pass, and then it's like, and he'll take it and he'll do the Matthew pass, and then you'll play the exact same 2, 3, 4 levels, and it's like 400% better just because, you know, he's had the Matthew pass. Like I say, he's an amazing composer.
He were coming up with this before levels or after the levels? So
it would usually be, so a combination of two, mostly would be kind of after a lot of the content was already there, and he would be able to go away. I think what he does really well is he goes away and he really internalizes the content. Him and I will work closely together in terms of if he has questions about, you know, what is the motivation behind this? What is it exactly that we're trying to say? And he'll come back to me, after he's internalized kind of the creative direction, I guess, of a given segment of gameplay. He'll come back maybe with some ideas, even it might just be like a paragraph of text, you know, maybe with references and stuff like that. I'm a musician as well, you know, hobbyist musician. So I've actually, the end credit song in Tin Hearts, that was a thing I composed. Ooh. And wrote the music and lyrics for. So that's good because we have a common vocabulary. But all that means is that I can understand what he tells me, and I can also give him like references and stuff like that very quickly. And he's one of the people on the team where, like, I mean, to be honest, most our team gels really well together, but in the case of Matthew, it's almost like some silent communication where most of the time the first iteration will be perfect, and if there's something that I'd like to see slightly changed, I'll say yeah that's perfect, and over here what about a bit like this and a bit like that, and then the next draft that comes back is perfect, like, immediately. And we very rarely, if ever, have had to go on anything, not just this project, on a third draft. Usually he'll send me back the first draft, I'll be like blown away, like you. Or if there's a slight change that's needed, I'll give him the feedback, and then that next draft, blown away and be like, yes, that's it, or that's exactly what I was saying, So he's very super talented, and the great thing is that he's an amazing musician, but he's very technically astute as well, because a lot of the stuff in Tin Hearts and other projects that we worked on, I don't think it's super obvious. So we use a middleware called WWISE. It's pretty popular, I guess. Next to FMOD is maybe the next kind of most popular kind of middleware for audio and games. And he's an absolute magician with that. Not so much in Tin Hearts, but another project. We were doing some really crazy stuff with like adaptive soundtracks and dynamic kind of music and stuff like that. Tin Hearts has a bit of that as well. He will go, not only does, cause in bigger projects, you'd have multiple people, right, doing the composition. He does all the, outreach to the musicians, cause he likes to work with, physical musicians, which again, kind of pretty old school in this day and age, but, we like what we like, I guess. So he will do all the outreach to the musicians. He will organize them, the orchestra stuff, everything. But then he also goes into the middleware, which is a pretty, me as an engineer, ex-engineer, I guess, still do a bit of code. When I look at WWISE, I'm like, whoa. Visual Studio looks simple compared to...
Yeah.
So, he will go in there and he will set everything up. And even implementation in Engine, in Unity, right, he can do a bit of like simple scripting or visual scripting to set stuff up. So, yeah, he's extremely autonomous and, self-driven and independent. So all the praise that the audio, in the game and the music has received directly goes to him.
It's amazing. It's amazing to have also somebody like a colleague to work with that has this strong sense of independence and knows, like, doesn't require to, like, a lot of back and forth and discussion, and tries to understand what you mean and then provide you with the full result, like, from end to end working.
Oh, you wouldn't believe how amazing that is. As a manager on projects, it's invaluable. But yeah, that is true for pretty much everyone on our team as well. You know, when we hire, we make it very clear that, you know, we like kind of being small and knowing everyone, and kind of, you know, most days you'll talk to pretty much everyone on the team as part of the daily collaboration. And, you know, I personally, having worked at teams with, you know, 100, 200 people, which I also enjoyed, you know, at the start of my career. But I definitely prefer, you know, this kind of way of working where you stick your fingers in many pies. But we make it clear to, you know, when we hire, that, you know, you're going to need to work like that. And sometimes you'll feel like you don't have enough support, and, you know, but of course, you know, make that known and we will support you. But, you know, the people who really thrive in our studio, in our culture, are the people who embrace that and, yeah, you know, they go, oh, okay, I see this needs doing. I've not really done something like that before, but I have an idea for how we might do it, and be like, yeah, go on, you know, have a go, you know. So yeah, that's definitely the kind of individual that we like to employ, and yeah, it works well, I think, for everyone.
I have one question that is more related to design of Ten Hearts. So Ten Hearts is a funny game in this regard that usually the games select whether narrative or the mechanics are the focus and have the emphasis. And I feel in Ten Hearts it's quite balanced. It's obviously a puzzle game, so you have levels and you need to like get through the levels to advance. But on the other hand, the narrative aspects and the story is not like, it's very important. And the things that you do within the levels, they are really connected to the story, and they have it. You can't really like rip the story apart. Like if you're not interested in the story, probably you will not be also finishing the game, I would say, right? So how does it look like from the design perspective? Well, first of all, do you think there is an emphasis on one or either of these? And like, do you think it's make the Ten Hearts easier to advertise, for example, or on the contrary? Like, how do you view this?
Yeah, so there wasn't there wasn't any commercial angle to that decision. Again, I think it was kind of a very personal personal decision in that. So we did start out to make a puzzle game, right? Let's start there. As in like an arcade, you know, like almost a completely kind of Lemmings puzzle game. In fact, I think I can be very honest about this. When, you know, back in when it was a VR only game, we were looking at the VR landscape and, we wanted to do something kind of quick and simple, actually, which is very ironic given where we ended up with the project. But, yeah, so then we thought, you know, let's base it. If it's going to be quick and simple, and it's going to be us, because at the time, you know, 2016, going back all the way back then, it was pretty much actually after Lionhead shut down. So I was actually already doing kind of indie game stuff, and then, I had some friends from Lionhead join me, and the idea was we were going to do something, and I was already kind of, you know, I had my ear to the ground when it comes to the VR stuff, and I knew that there was kind of there was some investment appetite, which again, like I said, ended up being the case. I had like some amazing strategic kind of insight there. There was a lot of that was luck. But the angle, you know, from a business development point of view, the angle was we're going to try and, so basically we were pretty cynical about, at the time, about making a Lemmings clone in VR, because we noticed that it was, when we were prototyping ideas in VR, we noticed that there was something very magical and interesting about interacting with small things. There were many games kind of back then sort of doing, you know, gameplay in sort of normal human kind of scale, but not that many games kind of doing interactions with like small things in this sort of tight space kind of in front of you. And that was kind of, we're like, okay, this is really cool. In fact, there was a demo in Valve's Aperture Labs suite of like demos that they'd put out back then, which was like a little portal themed thing. It's like a little pocket universe of like those little portal stick men from like their funny kind of infographics. And that was amazing and hilarious, but also it was like really magical how you could feel, you know, the sense you got from like looking down on these things. And we're like, that's it. This is it. We need to make a game that tackles this somehow. And then we're like, okay, how about Lemmings? We looked around with no other Lemmings games. So that's how it came to be, right? It was going to be kind of a cynical, almost like Lemmings clone. So we're like, okay, come on, let's come up with some puzzles. And that's it. But then I think we love stories, right? We love telling stories. I personally, I'm a big cinema buff. I like books. I like movies. I like, you know, TV. And then we had some other people as well on the team kind of sharing similar characteristics. And, you know, we were toying around with this idea of like, could we, you know, tie this progression of levels together with some kind of narrative? And and then I think, you know, that was it. Like we came up with a toy soldier. I think our art director at the time, Ian, he did like an amazing concept of the toy soldier that everyone loved. So it was very organic. And, you know, and then we're like, okay, we love this character. This is the character for, you know, the Lemming character. And then we're like, and then, you know, the designers, myself and some of the other designers were like, but why is it a toy soldier? You know, who made him? You know, why? You know, what's the background? Do they have a family? Like, what was the professional situation? And he looks a bit steampunk. Could it be like Victorian times? And okay, what would the context be around them at that period of time? And then, you know, a lot of personal kind of, self kind of questioning and sort of, you know, those kind of inner dialogue that everyone kind of has around, you know, because again, I don't know if you finished the game or, you know, where you are with it, but, you know, I guess, and again, without spoiling too much, I like to say it's a contemporary tale, you know, about kind of the balance between sort of career and professional kind of, aspirations and ambitions, you know, but also kind of how you balance that with life and, you know, the things that life might throw at you and, you know, where you choose to kind of focus. And also, you know, there's this kind of theme of time, right? You, in the game, you have this mechanic of fast forwarding time and rewinding time and pausing time. And it's like, time is like an infinite resource, but it's like, is it really though? Like, is time an infinite resource in real life, or is it actually really finite? And like the decisions you make, you know, and how they affect your relationships, you know, they might be kind of irreversible. So it's kind of like, you know, it tackles, you know, relatively contemporary kind of themes, I think, around, you know, the things I just said, kind of career and family, but in a way that's kind of dressed up as a kind of, you know, almost like Pixar-like kind of aesthetic. It started off as a puzzle game, but then I think almost inevitably, given our love for telling stories, you know, memorable, meaningful stories, a lot of those elements kind of started sort of shoehorning themselves into the experience. But we wanted to do it in a way, and it was interesting kind of hearing you talk about, you know, where is the emphasis? We kind of wanted to do it in a way where the player would decide where the emphasis is, right? So, and this is why, apart from, you know, there's maybe like a handful of cutscenes where we grab the camera and kind of do the cutscene ourselves. But most of the cutscenes are kind of like, you know, the Half-Life sort of style of cutscenes where, you know, you're just there, in the environment. And you witness the cutscene yourself. But yeah, for the most part, it's all kind of self-driven. You decide where to put the emphasis as the player, whether it's the puzzles or the story. And we try not to dictate that. It's completely, player driven. But yeah, it's been very interesting as well to see how, you know, in the reviews and stuff, some players will say, you know, I love the puzzles. You know, I didn't care too much about the story. And that's fine, you know, and then other players would focus on the story and, you know, they'd say kind of, you know, I enjoy the puzzles. Some of them were quite tricky. I just kept playing to see what happens next kind of thing. So, you know, that's exactly kind of what we wanted. We wanted the players to decide where to focus. So yeah, I think that worked out quite well.
Okay. Yeah. I think, yeah, the story is definitely a big part of Tin Hearts, I think. And maybe, it might be interesting to see, like, whether the older players were actually more in touch with the story because of the themes that you bring in the story, or maybe younger people were more after puzzles. That would be my guess, but it would be interesting to see the, like, a taxonomy or something. Yeah. Okay. I have also one designy question related to controls in the game, because mm-hmm. you know that, first of all, we have this 3D walking person, ghost. So this controls pretty straightforwardly in like every 3D game, right? But then you need to be able to switch to the toy soldier that is also 3D. So it has like a additionally jump. But apart from that, I think the controls are pretty similar. And then you have the control scheme for moving the prisms. And then you have the hands also for controlling and manipulating things. So, how did this look like in terms of development? When did you decide, like, when it's time to integrate a new thing for the controlling part? Like, how did you end up with the different controlling schemes?
Yeah, so the blocks, which obviously I guess kind of like the core mechanic when it comes to the interaction with the environment and, you know, how you set up the paths for the toy soldiers, you know, they were already there in the VR version, and you know, it's quite natural in the VR version where you can just pick something up and place it somewhere else. Obviously, as the levels get bigger, we also have the kind of telekinesis, I guess, mechanic from, you know, that's other VR games have, where, you know, you can remote possess, we call it, something, an object from a distance, and then you can push and pull it with a stick and rotate it. And, you know, you're almost kind of doing the same sort of natural interactions from a distance. You know, because of, you know, 6 DOF kind of controllers and, you know, the depth perception in VR, these interactions feel quite natural thing. I don't think that many players have issues in VR with those interactions. With mouse and keyboard or controller, obviously a bigger challenge. You know, I don't think we still solved it perfectly, you know, given, you know, we do see on occasion some reviews kind of mentioning controls as a friction point. And the worst thing about that is that, you know, we're completely blind to it ourselves. Like, you know, have, this is the problem, right? When you're developing a game for so long, everyone on our team is like completely proficient, like, you know, and I've also seen many playtesters, like just kind of, you know, flying blocks about, placing blocks, like jumping to the other thing, moving around, switching to Albert, switching to blocks, switching to cannon, switching to drums, and, you know, just moving things around. So it's like, yeah, okay, I guess it works, right? But then, you know, we'll on occasion see a comment on a forum or a review where it's like, controls, you know, could be better. It's like, but then there's never any detail, like, you know, other than that. It's like, okay, how, you know, it is a side effect of, you know, going back to what we were saying about lots of mechanics and kind of lots of, you know, all the tools that we add to the arsenal, and pretty much every new tool kind of has its own kind of interaction method that needs to feel as intuitive as possible for that particular object, but also needs to feel consistent with what you've already learned, right? So, and sometimes those things might align, other times they might be completely counterproductive, and we have to come up with the way where that's hidden. Like, you know, it feels like they're using the same controls, but actually slightly different, but, you know, to the player, it's super intuitive. And for the most part, I think we've done a really good job of that. You know, it has a ton of controls, you know, when you press pause and it shows you the controller diagram, and it's like, whoa, you know. But the other thing we tried to do with that was, you know, going back to what we were saying about like gradually kind of introducing mechanics, was kind of not throw the player in a level where, you know, all of that is unlocked immediately. We kind of, you know, I like to call it like the Zelda approach, where, you know, there's an obstacle, and, you know, there's no tutorials really. It's like, it's, you know, every time you learn something, it's a puzzle that you have to overcome, and you learn the mechanic and the way you control it by overcoming that obstacle. So, you know, pretty much the first half of Act One is that, right? It's like an hour long kind of tutorial where we, you know, unlock a lot of the mechanics that you end up using in the rest of the game, but it's done quite gradually, you know, to the point where I think, you know, some of the reviews that we've seen, you know, people go, this is an amazing game, but you won't think it's an amazing game until about an hour in, which is kind of like, you know, it's almost like the worst thing you can do these days, you know, with people's attention spans. And in fact, we went in and in a recent patch and kind of put a big dialogue option at the start of the game that says, do you want the short tutorial, you know, which is like five minutes or whatever? Do you want like the original experience, which is more like 20 minutes of, you know, this kind of mechanic unlocking? For me personally, you know, I really wanted to make sure we don't leave anyone behind. That's, you know, that's how I've been kind of saying it. It's like, don't leave anyone behind in terms of, you know, if you're a more casual player that's not that adept with, like, you know, lots of controls and controllers and, you know, mouse and keyboard, and, you know, you don't have necessarily that kind of hand-eye coordination, that dexterity. I wanted to make sure that onboarding is gradual and slow and, you know, at their pace, so that they do get to enjoy like the narrative, right? And that was kind of, you know, a conscious decision, because like in our heads we were saying, a hardcore player, yes, they will whine about the slowness, but they will probably persevere through it, right? It will go, come on, man, this could be faster, but, you know, but they still will play through it as much as they complain about it. Unless, you know, hardcore player, they will give up, right? And that's what we wanted to avoid. You know, they will give up on something that they might end up enjoying. And I have seen countless streams of, you know, players, you know, like cozy streamers and, you know, players who I wouldn't consider, you know, I might be wrong, maybe, you know, they play their, you know, I don't know, like strategy games with like, you know, a billion different button combinations, but you know, I would consider potentially, you know, more casual players, but they play the game to the end, and, you know, they solve the tricky puzzles, they figure out all the controls, and that makes me so happy, right? Like, for every one player like that completes the game, and, you know, and then they go, pretty much everyone who completes the game, they tend to like absolutely love it. And you know, we've watched many streams as a team. You know, we always enjoy watching someone reach the very ending because it's always a very kind of powerful sort of emotional experience. So we always enjoy watching that. So for every player like that, like a more casual player that gets to that point and, you know, they have that viscerally kind of emotional experience, you know, that's like 10 more hardcore players kind of, you know, whining about the slowness or, you know, some, you know, I don't know, like over tutorialization of like, okay, sure. But, you know, I'm glad that we allowed this person to like fully enjoy it. Right.
Yeah, the choice for the tutorial, like you are the player can pick the tutorial length and like the kind of tutorial was amazing. I think it should be included in other games as well, because like for me, I picked the longer one, even though you kind of played a lot of games and I felt why people that do tend to play games a lot may feel that this is slow. Yeah. But I picked this on purpose to see like what will be the teaching process for the mechanics. Like this is really smart to just, you know, other people like people that tend to play the games, they will figure out the controls, right? But if you don't want to lose other players, like more casual players, having the tutorial for them but not obligatory for other people, I think it was very smart.
I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, you say smart. It was a reaction.
Yes.
I wish we were smart in the first place, in all honesty. But yeah, you know, these are the kind of things you learn. And it's hard to know, you know, and if you have more time, you can do more play testing in advance. We kind of learned this while the game was live. But yeah, we took the time to add it. And yeah, more choices are never, you know, can never be a bad thing, right? You might think that this is the way to play it, but at the end of the day, it really, you know, is the player, it's the player's opinion that matters.
Yeah.
You know, giving them more choice is never a bad thing.
Let's turn to the more retrospective part. What lessons have you learned from the development of Tin Hearts, and what do you think, how will you adapt in the future?
Don't take 7 years to do a game is one lesson. No, yeah. So like I said, you know, it wasn't 7 years kind of in terms of continuous time. But yeah, I think, you know, we did already touch on this. You know, there's definitely, I mentioned like the uncompromising approach to like the vision. Yes, you know, I'm very happy with that, where we ended up with the end product. You know, it did mean, like we said already, you know, it was like at least a kind of 6 month delay from the original release window. You know, that sort of thing does put pressure on the studio. I think, yeah, so again, so that's potentially something where we, you know, we might want to kind of be more compromising in the future, you know, as much as I take pride in, you know, the uncompromising approach. I think there might be a better balance in the future. Along those same lines as well, you know, talking about going back to the thing we're saying about like the introduction of lots of mechanics, and how, you know, it made for a super kind of fresh experience. Like almost every level, there's like 50 levels in the game, and like pretty much every level would introduce a new thing and then combine it with the things before as well in interesting ways. That's great, but it kind of, you know, from a combinatorial kind of perspective, right, it adds a lot of pressure to like the QA process, the engineering process, obviously, especially, and again, I don't want to repeat information that your Toby episode will cover, but yeah, especially when you have things like time controls, Right? Everything needs to work forward in time, exactly. But also backwards in time.
Yeah.
That is insane. It's yeah. Like, you know, I'm sure Toby.
Yeah, really we discussed this in depth.
Yeah, yeah, he often goes, I'm never working on a game with rewind ever again. Which, yeah, I fully understand. Which again, you know, like, and this is potentially another learning, you know, like, it's amazing how, you know, with Unity, Unreal now being free, you know, back when I started my career in games, you know, I've got so many abandoned projects because, you know, I'd go like, oh, I've got this game idea. And then I was like, all right, okay, cool. Let's start making it. And it's like, okay, now, okay, I've got a camera system and I've got an input system and I've got a rendering system. I was like, okay, one of these days I'm going to start working on the actual game. Yeah. Okay? But yeah, hang on. I need an audio engine now. And, you know, and it's like, and you know, 2 months in, you're still building, you know, the scaffolding for the game. And at that point you're like, oh my god, you know, time has moved on, you know, I don't even remember what game I was making. You know, these days it's like, grab Unity, grab Unreal, grab a bunch of assets from the asset stores, and you know, within a couple of days you can be prototyping your game idea, right? Now obviously, to the degree where you can rely on this process for full production, or the degree to which you can rely on this process is very varied, you know, and I think you need to really look at your underlying framework and tools and, you know, what it is you're using very carefully, you know, because in our case, for example, we were using some third party thing for the time control stuff, ended up being completely unreliable for full production. I mentioned, you know, relying on Unity's physics engine, we had to roll out our own solution. I think, you know, it's hard to know. I think hindsight is 20/20 and all that. With experience, I think it's you develop insight, or, you know, your perception for what you might be able to rely on, what third party thing versus what you know, you'll need to roll out your own solution. I think you start developing the perception for, you know, where that division lies. But yeah, in our case, I think we maybe took too long to bite the bullet and go, no, this needs to, you know, we need to roll out our own thing for this. So that, yeah, again, that's certainly something where in future projects, I think we will, you know, potentially choose faster, you know, where we use some third party thing versus do our own thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, having said that, it is amazing. Like, I don't look back to those days with any nostalgia. I had to write everything kind of myself. What else? There's probably, you know, loads if I sit here and think about them, but yeah, these are, okay. I guess these are kind of like the top three. Did I mention three? For some reason I think it was three, but yeah, let's go with three. Yeah. I can think of right.
Okay now. Okay funny, I asked the same question to Toby, and Toby said that if you think that a system needs rewriting, spend a week and rewrite it. Because if you're in a scenario where you add more systems as things grow, and with each new level you have new mechanics, the requirements for the system change over time so much that you need to at some point rewrite it and make it usable for all the...
Yeah, absolutely. And you also end up like potentially making changes and adding technical debt to a thing that should be refactored as part of building this other system that is dependent, right? So then that makes the refactoring of the original system harder.
Yeah.
Because now you have to refactor not just the initial system, but also the stuff that you added to support this dependent system, right? So yeah, I think for sure, you kind of have to go, no, before we do this, let's refactor this thing. It's hard though, you know, like say hindsight 2020, and these learnings from the perspective of, okay, it's done, it's over there, now we can look at it and we can calmly, you know, make these insights, it's easy. But when you're in the thick of, you know, of production, and it's like, oh, we, you know, there's a publisher milestone, or we have some external, you know, deadline, some sort of Steam Next Fest thing or something, you know, we can't really do both the refactor and support the requirements of this other thing. It's quite hard.
That's why it's tricky. Calls. That's why it's tricky. Right. Okay. Thanks a lot. Do you have any closing thoughts where people can, for example, follow Roxan developments? Things like that.
Yeah, we're Roxan Games on Twitter or X, if you like calling it that. I don't think I'll ever get used to that. Roxan Games on Twitter, and Roxan.com is our website. The game is out on Steam, Xbox Game Pass, I mentioned. So if you're a Game Pass subscriber, you know, you can just, after finishing listening, watching this interview, you can just, you know, load it up on Game Pass and have a go, see what you think. Make sure you choose the right tutorial if you're so inclined.
Thank you. Thank you for your time and effort and the conversation. It was really nice.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. And yeah, really enjoyed our chat.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.